first, more often than not, protests get mixed reactions from the public. People criticize the issue at hand or how the protest is done, the time, the place, and more. But there are protests and protesters that most Americans are likely to regard as good. Looking back at Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., even the Boston Tea Party, their actions are considered positive and live in history books. But at the time, officials in Montgomery and supporters of segregation around the nation didn't like Parks or King, and the British Crown presumably didn't think too highly of the Boston Tea Party either. So what has to happen before controversial disobedience is eventually considered a, quote, good protest worthy of our kids' history books? Kevin Gover is the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, where he has overseen exhibits on protests. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, a lot changes when we're looking at a protest that's happening now versus looking at it through the lens of history. How do you approach that distance in your museum?
Well, I suppose we, like everyone else, I mean, I think you nailed it in your introduction. In the moment, very rarely are protests widely thought to be a good thing. As you point out, Dr. King's protests were a clear majority of Americans didn't think that they were a good idea. And that's true of pretty much every mass social movement, is that they are not thought of as being a good thing in their time. And it's only when the society sort of catches up with the position that the protesters are advancing that we look back and say, yeah, that Rosa Parks, what a hero. Yeah, that Martin Luther King, what a hero. And it's, you know, they don't always succeed. In fact, I think it's fair to say, I suspect that most protests fail, most protest movements. And so I think it is in some part has to do with the, obviously, the nature of the issue, the character of the leadership in a particular movement and their wisdom and acumen and ability to understand sort of both the national zeitgeist and the political realities in the moment. It depends on what the media chooses to do. And that's becoming a more and more complicated question now as social media begins to have such an effect and we all can seek out the media with the point of view that we prefer. And so, so all of that is to say, I don't think it's possible to predict. Think back. I remember, you know, in 1968, when those athletes raised their black gloved fist at the Mexico Olympics. And man, I'll tell you, I didn't know anybody who thought that was a great thing. And yet now those men are ensconced in the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and thought of as cultural heroes and for their protest. So you know, looking at it in the moment, we're almost always going to get it wrong, I think.
Do we get it right when we look at it later, though? Because when we look back at the civil rights movement, I mean, as I learned it early on, it's this simple story: bad things are happening. Rosa Parks sat on the bus, Martin Luther King gave the I Have a Dream speech, things got better. I'm oversimplifying even an oversimplified version, but do we tend to sanitize and miss all the false starts and the other people that we didn't know about when we look back?
Oh, absolutely we do. And we do that, you know, we do that both in our understanding of our national history, and frankly, we do it in understanding our personal history. I mean, you know, I like that good story about myself as opposed to the more complex, messy one where I did things that weren't so good. And I think as a country, and not just the U.S., but any country will tend to do that and choose the tidier version of history. It's very difficult for us to really embrace the complexity and acknowledge the ambiguity and even the unmitigated evil that exists in our history.
We're talking to Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, about political protest and how we talk about it and represent it as it's happening and in history. Kevin, I want to look at a couple current day examples. You mentioned a sports-related protest in 1968, and there's a lot of sports-related protests, the kneeling during the national anthem in the NFL and some other professional sports. As you look at that, what are you thinking about as far as the conversation?
Well, I think that protest can be effective when it is associated with a broader political / legal / social strategy to make real progress on an issue. So if these athletes are protesting police violence against black men, and it's yet to be seen whether that will be followed up with real changes in our social circumstances, so that black men are not targeted unfairly. And I think that is very much an open question, you know. And I think there's a real risk that the protests sort of peter out over time if there's not a clear social, legal, political strategy for pressing forward on the issue.
A lot of the argument there, the public argument, hasn't been so much in the content, the goals of what the players are looking for, but the timing. During the national anthem, the argument is that's not the appropriate time. Has this been an argument about protests that we've been talking about in American history?
Sure, always. They said that it was not the appropriate time for the athletes in 1968 to protest any time except during the playing of the anthem while they're receiving their medals. And of course, from their perspective, it was, well, what better time? When else is everybody going to be focused on us? And so that's the moment of greatest impact. And I'm sure that's much of the thought that the NFL players have right now. I mean, if they went and held a press conference after the game, I'm not so sure that many people are going to show up, and it certainly wouldn't be televised.
And another current protest going on involves pipelines, and this is an issue led in many cases by Native Americans from a variety of tribes around the country. And this was an issue at your museum, a centerpiece from the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, went on display at the National Museum of the American Indian. Why did you want to have that on display?
Well, of course, part of our job at the National Museum of the American Indian is to document contemporary Native American life. And it just so happened that we had an exhibition about treaties between the United States and the Indian nations. And at its heart, for the Cheyenne River and Standing Rock Sioux, the issue was about treaty and treaty property and treaty rights. And so it was clearly relevant to the story we were trying to tell about these treaties. And so we were very glad to receive this object that really embodies what was going on at Standing Rock, with all of these different tribes coming together to protest on behalf of the rights, the treaty rights of a couple of tribes.
I think a lot of times when people go to a museum, maybe me too, I expect it to be about the past. This is stuff that already happened, and a concern people might have is, well, this is a current issue on display at the museum. How do you see that fitting into the role of a museum?
Yeah, I think we always have to be very careful in curating the present. For the reasons you and I were just discussing, it's very difficult to get a complete perspective in the moment on what it is we're seeing and what its significance really is. And so, we have to try to be very humble and very fair in our presentation. It simply wouldn't be true to say those of us who work at the museum are objective. But I think that it is fair to say that we're scrupulous about being honest about what we say. And so our presentation of the issue describes what happened, described how the tribes came together to object and to protest the pipeline. And then, we do not say what our opinion is about what the outcome should be, because that's just not our place.
Kevin Gover is with us. He's director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. We're looking at the history of protest in the U.S., which protests we deem good in the moment or later on, and why. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think qualifies as a good protest? Are there lines that protesters should and shouldn't cross? What are they? Is it okay if they ruffle feathers in order to get attention to the cause they're working on? And were you involved with the protest movement now or at some point in your life? How did you feel about the way people talked about it? How do you feel about history looks back on it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing the conversation now with Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. We're looking at the history of protest in the United States and when we deem protests good and appropriate, bad and inappropriate, and how we look back on them through the pages of history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think is an example of a good protest, an effective protest? When is a protest not justified? And you can look at ones current, the ones that during the national anthem or the pipeline protests or the civil rights era. What do you think of the way we talk about the civil rights era protest? Did you live through that? Did you participate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kevin, as you were talking a few moments ago, I thought of the protests this year related to the removal of Confederate monuments. I mean, those themselves came into place 40 or 50 years after the Civil War. So that was one view of history. Now we're reviewing it. We never get the final draft, do we?
No. And that's a very important point. We are constantly revisiting and revising our history. And I think it's a natural process that collectively somehow we come to different conclusions over time. And it's very interesting to me when people try to push back against the conclusion that the society is reaching. And so, for example, a number of scholars and a number of civic and political groups worked very hard, including, I might add, the Ku Klux Klan, to say that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about states' rights, and it was a noble endeavor, and it was a lost cause, but the Confederacy was a good thing. Well, you know, these days, most historians would say, well, no, the war was about slavery, and the defeat of the Confederate Army is an unambiguous good. But the other interesting thing about that is we've got this history all around us in our public spaces, and we rarely bother to think about what it means. And so, you know, finally someone stands and ponders, well, what does it mean to have a Confederate general in the center of a major public space? What does it mean to have Christopher Columbus, who was a villain to Native American people, being honored in so many of our major cities in very significant ways, in D.C. and New York, and really in many parts of the country. And I'm actually a little less interested in the outcome. I guess I don't believe in the destruction of these things. I believe in their that we should interpret them in light of our modern sensibilities and say, this is who this guy really was. This is what this person was really fighting for. And even go so far as to say in the case of Confederate generals, his defeat was an unambiguous good because 4 million people were freed from slavery. But that requires a very mature society and one that really is willing to embrace the complexity of history. That's why I think Europeans are better at it than we are. They've become more comfortable with the complexities of their history. But it's because, you know, their cultures are much older than the American culture.
I want to bring on our callers now. Steve is with us in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi. Of course, it's important to consider the impact that your protest is going to have. You want to make sure that your behavior isn't going to negatively impact the cause. In the case of the NFL players, I support them 100% in taking a knee. And I think it's interesting when you're talking about the Dakota Pipeline and the NFL players, you're talking about minority groups who are typically disenfranchised and don't have access to the media. And so they choose the only means they have of getting their message out. And I salute the bravery of the NFL players. And I think it's obvious that they're having an impact. They've even drawn the ire of the President of the United States. And I hope they continue to do it in a respectful manner the way they have so far.
Steve, thanks for the call. Steve, giving one perspective on those protests. Kevin, your thoughts?
Well, I think that that's right, that it's very easy. It would be very easy for the players to lose the support of those who support them by behaving obnoxiously or by using the wrong language in describing what they're doing. It is a very subtle thing. I think that we have to acknowledge, though, at least from the polling I've seen, that they do not enjoy majority support, at least among NFL fans, for what they're doing. And so it's not a perfect solution, but I agree with the caller that they're doing it in the way they're doing it and the time they're doing it because that's the way to bring attention to the issue they believe in.
Steve, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, talking about protest and how we talk about protest. Lynn is on the line now in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Rob and Kevin. I've been involved in some protests, and there is generally a contingent among us who volunteers to act out within the law and risk getting arrested because that's the only way the general press will cover the issue. It's very uncomfortable. It's not a walk in the park. It's not a bunch of spoiled people just out trying to get their way. But until we acknowledge that there's injustice, there's no other way to go about it, I don't see.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, the idea of civil disobedience, of course, Kevin, has a long history in protest. And Lynn saying, if you want to get people's attention, the media's attention, that may be the only way sometimes.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case, and history would bear that out. Peaceful civil disobedience can make the protesters the sympathetic parties. That's certainly what happened during the civil rights movement. And the response of the authorities to that peaceful civil disobedience really drove more people into their camp. Most folks are a little smarter than they were in the South in the 1960s in using their power against peaceful protest. But you know, sometimes it is dangerous, and I really do have great respect for peaceful civil disobedience.
I want to bring up the concept of kind of mixing the spheres of our lives. And this has a lot to do with the sports protest. People do say sometimes, yeah, your cause, maybe I agree with it, maybe I don't. But if we're talking about sports or comics or computer games or whatever, I don't want politics bleeding over. I get plenty of that everywhere else. Is it appropriate for people to kind of cross those the genres, the entertainment and the politics?
Well, I don't know what part of our lives are immune from that, and there's just a long, unbroken history of our entertainers somehow being involved or bringing politics to the table. Now, you know, you're not going to see an NFL player stop in the middle of a play and hold up a sign. Because they're football players and they're going to do their job. But when they're not doing that, why shouldn't they be able to express themselves? We look to them as heroes and people to be admired, many of us do, And they choose to use that influence and whatever charisma they might possess to advance an issue that they feel strongly about. I don't think there's any part of American life that's immune. I mean, we even have politics in our churches, and most folks apparently don't object to that because the churches have become very important in social and political movements. So, no, I don't think there's a place in American life that is immune. At least none comes to mind for me.
Well, Kevin, we're going to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Kevin Gover. He's the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He joined us to look at the past and present of protests in America and which protests are regarded as good or valid in U.S. history. Still time for you to share your thoughts on these issues. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your thoughts and maybe your own experiences while you're at it.